Welcome to St. Louis on the Air and our legal roundtable. I'm Don Marsh. As Election Day approaches, voting issues go to the head of the line. Missouri is being cited as part of a national voter fraud pattern. Attorney Jane Duker of the Spencer Fain Law Firm was involved in two court cases concerning absentee ballot issues here in St. Louis. She is with us. Missouri voters are preparing to decide whether to require voter photo IDs in the Show Me State. Also on our agenda, the minimum wage, police excessive force, and a reporter's right to witness an execution. Aside from Jane Duker, our regular panelists are attorneys Bill Freivogel, who teaches journalism at SIU in Carbondale, and Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor of Students at Washington University, where he is also Director of the Career Center there. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Hi.
Hi.
Jane, I'll start with you.
Yes.
You've been much in the news lately with regard to the absentee ballot issues following the primary here. Mm-hmm. There are other issues that have surfaced in St. Louis County. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Trump is saying that St. Louis is an example of the voter fraud, which he says is going to produce a rigged election. Do the absentee ballot cases here and the ones that you're familiar with rise to the level of voter fraud?
No. It's not. It's obviously my opinion, no. Now, I think the Court of Appeals decision determined that the errors of the Board of Election in failing to require people to put absentee ballots in an envelope constituted legal fraud, but not fraud in any sort of sense. There was no evidence presented. And in fact, even the circuit court said there is no fraud. There's absolutely no evidence that someone voted in a way that they didn't want to vote or didn't vote for the candidate that they didn't want to vote for. And so there was really no question of the veracity of the ballots that were cast, which is incredibly important. I think that's a little different than what may be going on in St. Louis County. But the FBI is working on that, and I would assume. But the idea that there's widespread voter fraud is not accurate. The problem is, you know, there was a lot of coverage. There was a lot of allegations. There was a lot of things. And the court case came down to something very different than what was sort of out in the public arena. And so I think that's where the disconnect can be. And so I think so from a legal standpoint, he's wrong. Citing the 78th House District is not the poster child for voter fraud. It doesn't justify voter ID. It doesn't any of that. But the problem is there is a perception issue when you redo elections. And I think the challenging part of that case is now we're going to have, you know, there will be 30,000 absentee ballots, probably more than they're used to in the county, and now having to have, you know, them manually be put into envelopes and opened up with bipartisan teams and the things that are required, it could jeopardize getting election results the night of the election now. And the hard part is the envelope requirement has nothing to do with the veracity of votes.
The envelope requirement being the ballot must be in an
put
envelope.
In an envelope, right. Yeah. Which yeah. And we have machines that, you know, that you can't open up the machine for a touch screen and take it apart and put a ballot in there. So basically, and there was a subsequent court order that said that the touch screens had to be available for the disabled, mm-hmm. Which overrides state law. So it got very complicated very quickly.
Bill, with all of this, are you concerned about a voter fraud problem in this neck of the woods?
Well, no. I mean, I think that this claim of Trump's is absurd. Rick Hasson is the national expert on vote fraud. He did a book a few years ago looking at the elections from 1980 to 2012 and found no example of an election turning on voter impersonation. Now that's different than the, you know, the thing we're talking about in the 78th district involving the absentee ballots. But I mean, there might be sometimes a small election is affected by the way in which absentee ballots are handled. But the idea that a national election would turn on voter fraud is absurd. I suppose, you know, if you had a situation like 2000 where one state was decisive and there was a difference of 500 votes, you know, then maybe it would be something that you'd have to take a really good close look at. But in general, it's ridiculous.
Mark, right. What's your take?
Yeah, and if you look at the academic studies, like both the Brennan Center at NYU and Columbia have done studies, and they've basically said there's a better chance that somebody will be struck by lightning than you know, submit a fraudulent vote. And as Jane said, the instances that have come up have been clerical-type errors. But I think, you know, the combination of the motor voter law that passed and then, like Bill was saying, the Gore-Bush election really kind of made people think this is a big deal. And then we had the Supreme Court case that drew back parts of Section 5. The Voting Rights Act. So now you've got these state legislatures that are empowered to start passing laws and you know, one side characterizes them as voter protection, other characterizes them as voter suppression, mm-hmm. that they're limiting. And when you look at how these things are voted on, it's typically along straight party lines. So it makes you wonder about what's going on.
Go ahead, Bill.
I was just going to say the issue that Mark raises, I think, is a really important one. I mean, I'm more concerned about, you know, due to the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act, there's going to be a lot fewer federal monitors out watching the polls in the South. And there was just a recent Huffington Post story about how Roger Stone, who's this operative who is associated with Trump, his group had been printing out badges for voter protectors to appear in, you know, cities like Philadelphia. I wouldn't be surprised, but that they would consider St. Louis would be another place. You know, who have no authority whatsoever, and we're just producing these badges to make it look like they did. So I'm worried about intimidation.
And people are working on that within, the Democratic Party and that we're working with voter protection, working with the election authorities and, frankly, law enforcement and alerting everyone and having, you know, we are afraid. We've been hearing reports of people bringing guns to the voting. Sure. You know, I mean, there could be any variety of voter intimidation going out there. And so I think everybody is on high alert. Justice is aware of reports. And so, I mean, that's I see that as a bigger problem. The other stuff, the clerical stuff, that's all stuff that can be worked out and figured out and again, has never decided any sort of election here.
Any irregularity issues that come up seem to involve absentee ballots. I think what you cited some people who have done studies. I think Pew Research has done a study. And the figure that I remember is they claim that only 31 voter fraud cases out of a billion ballots cast that they could detect, which makes it not much of a problem if you follow those figures.
Right. I think the other place where there is sometimes fraud is in voter registration. You know, like if you have a group that's got giving incentives to its workers to try to sign up as many people as possible. Acorn here in St. Louis about, 10 years ago or something, had problems along those lines.
A lot of problems.
And there was a prosecution, I believe. Mm-hmm. So I think absentee ballots and voter registration. But again, you know, those things, it's not like those people are necessarily showing up at
I've served as a poll. I've gone to a poll for the Democratic Party where I was supposed to just watch and make sure nothing bad happened. And I sit on the sidelines and watch. But I do still agree with Bill, because you've got these people. You know, I mean, this is just so out of the normal that we have a candidate questioning the whole legitimacy of our process. Even, you know, Bush versus Gore. Yeah, Bush versus Gore, Nixon versus Kennedy. You know, Nixon conceded and didn't question the outcome, and Gore didn't question the outcome. We have this system where the rule of law prevails, and we don't question it. And so once you start having people in this position question it, then you start getting maybe these people out there who start taking things into their own hands, and
the poll
and that's
watchers,
what I worry about. Although
watchers.
I would think, you know, like in St. Louis, you know, the police, if you work a poll or something, the police are by all the time. Those people can reach out to the police. I think anything would be taken care of.
You alluded to this, but we have a tweet from C.D. Stelzer who writes, "If voter fraud is absurd in a national election, please explain the 1960 race in Illinois that gave JFK the win over Nixon." That is always cited as, you know, the Dempsey dumpster votes and that sort of thing.
It is. And I don't know the details of Illinois and the Daily Machine going for Kennedy. Maybe in 1960.
But that's 50 years ago.
Right.
And so if that's the best example we can come up with is 50 years ago.
And the other example that's always cited is Lyndon Johnson's first election
for the Senate,
where there was like a stuffing of ballots in precinct 13. Yeah, I think that's probably did happen, in a state election for U.S. Senate.
And, and there's actually been prosecutions in Missouri that didn't affect the outcome of any election, which meant that, you know, which is what is supposed to happen, is if anything untoward does happen, it's prosecuted. But there's never been anything that, that called into question an election.
I think St. Louis has also been called out. And I just vaguely remember, when was the year that they had to, they kept the, some of the polls open longer in St. Louis?
That was, so Bond was very angry that the polls were kept open to try to accommodate long lines in St. Louis, as I recall.
Correct.
And but I can't remember what election that was.
We also had some loose Chad cases here when the Roberts were running back in elections back early 80s, I guess. I think it was Mike Roberts who was running, and a vote was held up because of the hanging Chad cases.
And we actually, I worked on a case where we kept the polls open when the St. Louis County basically lost or didn't have enough ballots. We actually got better law on keeping the polls open than that case. Because, you know, we were able to keep the polls open for two more hours in order to allow people to vote. But people had to – they tailored the order such that the people coming back had to say, look, we did try to come during regular hours and were denied the right to vote. And so if they signed the affidavit, they could vote.
Yeah. I mean, I think our election system is a messy one. It's not a federal system. It's governed by states and localities. So you got lots of different rules. But that's the system we have. And sometimes – it doesn't run perfectly, but I think this idea that it's rigged, that there's the fix is already in. I just see that as being so outside. I mean, do I think all these local organizations are extremely competent and do an excellent job and all the time? No, I don't think that. But do I think they're able to somehow fix it? No, they can't.
It's delusional to think that all 50 states and all the localities
that they're in cahoots somehow,
that could somehow be orchestrated, even if you wanted to.
Right, the messiness and decentralization
is
actually helps us in this situation.
Absolutely,
it's not like the Russians can hack all those different operations.
That's come up a lot recently. Obviously, it's actually a protective mechanism. Before we move on to something else and take a break, getting back to Mr. Trump and the question of whether or not he will concede the election if he loses. I just have one question. Does a candidate have to concede for the election to be valid?
No.
No.
So it has no legal effect at all.
Yeah. No. It's a more political, we want to show the world and show ourselves that we have a peaceful transfer of power. And it's always been traditionally handled in that way because it's a message. I mean, it was very hard after Bush v. Gore, and it was important that Al Gore concede properly and tell people because, we are going to have to put this back together again after this election. And part of that process is the candidate who loses stepping up saying, okay, the process has worked. This is democracy. It's time to move on.
And we're still one country.
That's right.
And that we're not.
The candidates don't trump the system. No pun intended.
Yes,
okay, the pun was intended.
Very good, Jane.
The pun was intended.
You're fitting right in with this group, believe me. We have to take a break now. We'll do that and come back and move on to some other subjects. I do have a caller with an intriguing point to make here, I believe. We'll take him when he comes back. This is our Legal Roundtable panel discussion. My guest in studio, Jane Duker, from whom you just heard, Mark Smith, one of our regular panelists, along with Bill Freivogel. We'll continue the discussion in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Before we move on to some other things, I want to bring in Pianki, calling from Dogtown on the voter fraud issue. Then we'll move on. Pianki, go ahead.
Well, I'm not calling from Dogtown. I'm calling from North County. You must have unheard me.
Wherever. Go ahead.
But, here in my area, and I guess it's throughout the state of Missouri, all you have to do is produce, in order to get your ballot, a utility bill. And I have voted by producing a utility bill that may have been several months or even a year or so old and was able to vote. They never asked for an ID, no driver's license, anything, just produced the utility bill. And how do they know I am the person who's associated with that utility bill? I could have pulled it out of a trash can. That is a fact.
Sure, got it. Thank you for calling.
Well, what they do is when you show up at the polls, you still have to sign the voter poll book.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they compare signatures. And so I think you would have to know exactly who you're impersonating, and you would have to be able to duplicate their signature in order to avoid the system. And when you register to vote, you have to produce an ID that shows who you are, and again, you have your signature, and that signature is actually kept in Missouri's Consolidated Voter Registration database. And so, you know, like when they do initiative petitions and you need to check signatures, they compare your signature. So you would have to successfully, you know, defraud in that
right.
way. And so is it possible if you were very orchestrated and you knew exactly who you were defrauding and you had their signature and – you know, I guess it's potentially
possible, but you're also committing a felony.
Absolutely.
So it's against the law, and you could go to jail for it. And the
Absolutely.
Alternative is to have some kind of ID requirement, which would
disenfranchise
a bunch of people, you know, the elderly who don't have driver's licenses anymore. What are they going to do? My understanding of this Missouri amendment is a veteran's ID would not work, would not satisfy the requirement for an ID. And so we're putting all these – it reminds me very much of after the Civil War when you had all these people kind of coming in. We put all these barriers up to voting, literacy tests, other things. This is not that same level, but it's another thing that seems to get in the way of people voting when we don't – it's a solution in search of a problem. We don't have a problem.
And the idea that you would be able to know that this person who's – utility bill you stole yeah. is actually registered and know their signature.
And know they haven't voted.
And exactly. And that's yeah. the other thing, because if you go and you've already voted, they have that in the electronic poll book now. And if somebody comes after and says, wait a minute, I didn't vote, you're going to get busted. I mean, right. yeah. you know, it's hard.
So this may change after the election because there's this proposition on the ballot that would require
– constitutional amendment.
A constitutional
right.
amendment
yeah.
that would require – a voter ID.
It's made the Secretary of State's race a one-issue campaign, hasn't it? Because that's all they're talking about is the voter ID.
Photo ID.
Yeah.
And you know, as the other said, you know, the unfortunate thing about a photo ID is that it ends up disenfranchising people, mostly you know older people, African Americans, and you know we spend a lot of time in this country disenfranchising African Americans.
Jay Ashcroft was on this program a week or so ago, and he says that that's definitely not the case, that they can still use the utility bills. I'm so confused on this now because I thought of that. I said to him, what's the point then if you can go back to doing what we're doing now?
Well, is he saying that it would be a provisional – you would vote yes. a provisional ballot?
Actually, it's a full ballot.
Yeah.
If you sign an affidavit that says you are who you say you are with your utility bill, then you can vote a full ballot. And I guess that you would be prosecuted if it was ever found out that you were not that person. But it's complicated. It's and it's meant to be complicated so that people don't know that they even have that ability.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
That's where these voters who would be disenfranchised would come into the picture. Okay, let's move on. I wanted to get something, Bill, that you brought up in our discussions earlier this week about what to talk about today. You have advised me this morning that the American Bar Association is apparently afraid of Donald Trump, and this bothers you.
Yes. So the you know the media law portion of the ABA did a report on Donald Trump's many libel lawsuits, and the fact that he has only won one of the many that he has. Filed, and that one against, I think, a Miss Pennsylvania was because she didn't show up, and there was a default judgment.
Right.
and so the media laws section of the ABA did a report calling Trump a libel bully, and then the ABA decided that it shouldn't be released because they were afraid Trump would sue them. Mm-hmm. You know, what gutless behavior! Of course, the media laws resource. Group then immediately posted the report on its website,
right.
So it's out there. But I'd hate to think of the ABA was in charge of news organizations being afraid. Oh well, maybe somebody's going to sue us for calling him a bully. Oh my gosh!
So, so I'm going to defend the ABA.
Oh, come on, Mark.
Well, because the guy who wrote it, he was my law school classmate, so he's a nice guy. So Demos in this thing said no because the title of the article was "Donald J. Trump is a libel bully, but also a libel loser," which is. Would be a catchy law review article title, but
which
it's
also
not,
is true.
I was going to say it. Which part
but
of
bully
that?
And loser are such
subjective
loaded
terms,
and the ABA is not supposed to be very nonpartisan. And so, what the ABA, overgroup was saying was, look at why. Let's just change a few words here and not be all partisan and be above this.
Right. I gotta side with you.
I believed what I was saying. I'm just saying I'm defending it.
That was a good effort. but I, the idea that you're being partisan if you are factually correct. Mm. I mean, we've gotten to the point now where you can't even, say your opinion. I mean, that bully is, it's subjective enough but it's also, true. And if we don't call this stuff out, I mean, now people are self-censoring. That's a problem.
And, this is really relevant to Trump because, just the other day he goes to Gettysburg to tell us how he's going to pull the nation together and precedes it with saying he's going to sue all these women who have said he, had unwanted – that he attack them sexually. And he's talked about
– And he wants to change the laws.
Changing
the
law. Exactly.
He's going to, which never mind that Constitution thing.
So, so he wants to change the law, change the Constitution. And we have had – and he's not the first person to do this. They're called SLAP lawsuits, right? Strategic lawsuits against public participation or something. Right. We've had some in St. Louis.
And we enforce that here.
So,
and that's good.
So, I'm not saying that his strategy is – it's a good one, or is it appropriate or anything? I'm just saying I can see where the ABA would say.
But if the ABA doesn't say this is out of the bounds of law,
who will?
Who will?
Right. Well, it's really hard to have a conversation about anything these days without Mr. Trump being a part of it somehow. So let's move on if we can. I wanted to talk about the Ferguson excessive force suit, which a federal judge dismissed a $40 million suit. They claimed police in Ferguson used excessive force on protesters following the Michael Brown incident. The police officers, according to the courts, were entitled to qualified immunity. And that's the one that stuck me. I'm not quite sure exactly what that means. Can we explain that? Anyone?
Well, I can take a stab at it. Qualified immunity means that you have to prove that when public officials are not acting in a ministerial capacity, meaning, you're told exactly what you have to do. If the requirements are met, you issue this license. Okay, that's a ministerial. When they have to exercise judgment and when they have to exercise discretion, and especially police officers because they're in very high charge situation and the judge focused a lot on the high charge situation surrounding the Ferguson unrest. And so if as long as you are not following a policy that would systematically take away someone's constitutional rights, then you are entitled to qualified immunity as a public official. And so if you're negligent, we are not going to hold you liable or your supervisors liable. But if you have to systematically and almost intentionally breach constitutional rights. And the court found, based on all the submissions, which was a very interesting – he did this on summary judgment, which was a very interesting way to do this because it's a very factual
–
yes, but in the judge's defense, you are entitled to know whether you are immune before you go through a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Immunity doesn't mean much if you actually have to finish the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. So having been defended public officials, immunity doesn't mean anything if you still have to go through 8 years of discovery and depositions and whatnot. And so the judge did sort of have an obligation to say, I have to resolve the immunity issues up front. And so that's what he did. But it was a very factually intense decision. But it does show you that when you get into the areas of immunity that you have to have a concerted, egregious effort to violate someone's rights. And he just felt on the record. And he was, I will tell you, it's an 84-page decision. He went through every single piece of evidence in detail.
Wow.
It was not a short shrift. And so he took all of the affidavits and all of the factual evidence And now, whether people will dispute that, and they may, and I've heard they're going to appeal, and that's completely legitimate. But he did make the effort to do that, and he found that this was not a systematic. We were dealing with a very unique, very charged situation, right. Yeah. And that's what he found.
The situation, as he outlined it, was people were throwing things at the police officers.
Absolutely,
the police had declared it to be an illegal assembly, and that the people had to disband. I mean, this was that.
And they were requested. They were requested. That was a big issue in the case,
right.
I saw, was that they were requested to disperse.
That's right. And so, you know, basically police have got to know, have to know that they are violating somebody's constitutional rights if they're going to be held accountable in court. And there's also Judge Autry also said, you know, we also defer to the, you know, reasonable judgment of the police officers on the scene, because, you know, the courts can't really be in the business of always second guessing, you know, a tough judgment that's made in this kind of an environment.
And you contrast that with policies. If there was a policy about – and there was a lawsuit about making the people move around, and right. they were doing goofy things to the press, and the federal court came in and said, we don't do that. And so this does not prevent anyone from changing those kinds of policies, but you're not going to find an officer personally liable or the city personally liable for money. You know, you don't second guess them. So right. I can't say it was crazy.
Yeah, and there were, the judge also spent a lot of time, as you had said – talking about what their allegations were and then what either video or subsequent testimony mm-hmm. From the same people who had alleged it, well, they said, well, no, I was not in the McDonald's at that time. Yeah, so if your allegation is somebody put a knee in your back and laid you on the floor and then you have a picture of them being arrested where they're not on the floor. And he spent a lot of time, as you said, in this really long opinion, going through all those facts. And a summary judgment motion, you know, for non-lawyers, it's where you come to the court and you say, look, judge, let's assume we've done pretrial discovery, which is we've taken sworn statements from people, we've entered exhibits. Let's assume all this stuff is true. Even if it's true, it doesn't rise to the level. And so, you know, you're not doing credibility findings. You're just saying, let's
assume it's undisputed.
Right. Yeah, it's
if
undisputed.
If it's undisputed, then the court's allowed to say, well, if this facts are undisputed, I can look at this as a matter of law.
And I want to sort of emphasize something Jane just said a couple of minutes ago, which was, I mean, this doesn't mean that the police were in Ferguson didn't do anything unconstitutional. I mean, as she pointed out, they had this ridiculous order that, well, you know, first they said you can't protest at night. That's unconstitutional. They said you have to keep moving,
walking in a circle.
Yeah. That was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Their use of tear gas was also found to be unconstitutional because it didn't. You know, they didn't have enough of a predicate for doing it. But we're talking here in this suit about a very particular. You know, the couple of days after the shooting when there were things being thrown at police, right. There were Molotov cocktails, there were places of business that were being lighted on fire, and these protests were being declared illegal assemblies.
While we're talking about the rights of police officers, let's talk about Chief Dotson in the city of St. Louis for a moment, who wants to run for mayor. And there's an awful lot of pressure being applied to keep him from doing that, at least while he's police chief. Now, as I understand it, there are two laws at work here. One is a state law, which says that a public responder can, in fact, run for public office. Mm-hmm. City ordinance, which says he cannot without resigning. Who gets the trump card in a case like this, state or city?
I think state law trumps city ordinance.
Generally, and I think, yeah, I mean, I've done a few of these cases where, you know, city ordinance versus state law, and you know, this one is a little closer call than some of the other ones I've dealt with because it is, you know, policing is sort of a unique local issue, and mm-hmm. it's not generally of a statewide policy. And so it would come down to whether there is a direct conflict between the ordinance and the local law versus the state law, and whether, you know, first responders, you know, was this meant to be a general policy? And even if the legislature says it's a general policy, would a court find that? And so I think generally you're right on the state law, and if I had to guess right or die, I'd say that. But I think this is a little bit of a unique issue, especially in light that it's police, and that is always been declared, you know, generally a local issue. So regardless of the legality of it, and maybe people will sue and it may come to that, but I think what people are trying to say is that politically, at this point in the city's history and where crime is, where it is, and where that this just is not what people think he ought to do. Now, granted, some of the people who are saying this are people who are running, right, and so right. they have their own interests.
A bunch of them, as a matter of fact.
A bunch of them, but there are a bunch that aren't. And there, I think there are a lot of people that think that this is really hard to let the people know that crime is the first priority when he may have political. So when he shows up at a press conference, is he the chief?
Right.
Yeah. Is he a candidate? Is he? So I think it's legitimate for people to ask those questions.
And what is he going to do? Not make his campaign money calls from, what, like 9 to 5? And then, I mean, and then he can do it the rest of the time. And what if somebody wants to meet with him? I mean, is he going to say, I can only meet you after 5? I just find
That's what he's saying. He's saying he would campaign in the morning and at night. Yeah,
I find that hard. I mean, that's not the way campaigns work.
Before we take another break, very quickly, the Board of Aldermen is working on a resolution or a statement of some sort, basically encouraging him to step down if he runs. I have read someplace that the board has the authority to fire him. Does the Board of Aldermen have the authority to fire the chief of police?
My understanding is under local control. That's the public safety director.
That's what I thought, too. Right.
Yeah, and the mayor directly doesn't even have the ability to do it. It would still have to
but
be.
But the mayor appoints the public safety director, correct? Or is it by the Board of A&E?
No, I think the mayor appoints. But I also think he's a civil servant now after the local control laws, which you don't get to just throw
who's
out.
Who's
civil
the public
servants.
Safety? Is that Eddie
Bryson?
Roth?
Eddie's.
So Bryson isn't it?
Longer.
No, it's someone else.
Because Eddie was one of the guys.
He's doing the homeless. He's doing human services.
He was sued on one of the cases we were talking
while
about.
While we sort that out, let me take a break. We'll come back and move on to some other things as well. But that's going to be an interesting one to watch as to how this shakes out. Back with our legal roundtable panel in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back as we continue our legal roundtable panel discussion with Jane Duger, Mark Smith, and Bill Freivogel. Anything more we need to say about the Chief Dawson's case? Okay, let's move along. A former reporter here at St. Louis Public Radio, Chris McDaniel, is suing for the right to witness an execution here in the state of Missouri. He was doing this because he wants to make sure that all procedures are followed properly with regard to the execution, a story that he has covered extensively while he is here. The state, of course, is arguing back, claiming that this is Chris is claiming this is a free speech issue, his right to witness an execution. That's another thing that strikes me as a little bit out of line with what this is all about. Bill?
Well, I mean, in general, a private citizen can't sue a state, you know, it's another state. It's actually the 11th Amendment, but there's an exception if the state is violating the Constitution, for example. So what Chris is arguing is that the so there's a state statute that says that 8 people are to be appointed to observe executions. He has volunteered to be one of those 8, and that the appointment of those people is a benefit, is a public benefit, and that you can't discriminate in the awarding of a public benefit based upon somebody's viewpoint towards the death penalty or their, that they're a reporter or that their reporter has written stories that are critical of the death penalty.
But reporters cover executions all the time.
Reporters do cover executions all the time. And then the state's response is that this is not a benefit. Mm-hmm. And so therefore he can't file the suit. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have standing. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
It's an interesting because when I looked at that, I thought because I worked in the governor's office and when I was chief legal counsel, I supervised executions, which was
fun part of the job.
Oh, I mean, I can't even go there. So, but I think there's a requirement for witnessing to ensure that the process is carried out properly. I am not sure that is the public benefit in the same way that he may be construing it because I think it's. it's for a specific purpose, and I don't think it confers a benefit. And just the idea of going down the path of having reporters, well, then what next? If there's a First Amendment right, then do you have to have a camera, and do we want a camera? And I'm just not sure that that path is, one, authorized by the law, and two, a path we may want to go down.
Hmm. Any other thoughts, Mark? Okay, well, let's move on to something else then. We'll see how that turns out, as we do with so many of the things we discuss on this program. A lot of constitutional amendments and propositions on the Missouri ballot this time. We can't talk about all of them. We've already alluded to the voter ID thing. Does everyone agree that if the voter ID, photo ID thing passes, it's going to be challenged? If taken to court?
I would be surprised if it's not.
Yes, you mean in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well,
yeah.
I mean, the Missouri Supreme Court would have to abide by the will of the people. I guess they could try to, the Missouri Supreme Court could say, well, now this constitutional amendment violates the U.S. Constitution, but the U.S. Supreme Court has already said in an Indiana case that photo ID requirements do not violate the U.S. Constitution. But, you know, depending on who is what the lineup of the new Supreme Court is, that's one of those decisions that could change.
But wasn't there a case in North Carolina in which the photo ID was tossed?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, but that was tossed not, if I remember correctly, that was tossed not on constitutional grounds, but rather on Voting Rights Act grounds.
Which, again, would be
under
federal,
Section 5, you mean?
Under federal law. No, I think, or was it, I'm not sure I'm if it was sure. Section 5, because oh, okay. there's other what, sections what where you put up barriers. I think mm-hmm. Section 2 prevents putting up the barriers.
What is Section 5?
Well, that was the one that got overturned, where you had to pre-clear anything.
The Voting Rights Act, you mean?
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
right.
Southern states had to pre-clear their vote.
And there
vote
may
changes.
Be a procedural way. The way the Missouri Supreme Court could address a constitutional amendment is if you don't have an unlimited right to change the Constitution, even by vote of the people. There could be other constitutional provisions that are violated that would allow the Missouri Supreme Court to look at it. I'm not sure if that's present here, but there are cases and I would suspect federal court would be the riper ground.
So I think the answer to your question is you can always challenge.
Right.
I mean, you can always find a lawyer to challenge it. Whether or not you're going to win is another matter. And I think it would be very tough in the Missouri Supreme Court case or in Missouri Supreme Court. And I think the United States Supreme Court would be tough as well, unless we had a major shift in the membership and some shift in their view of what the law requires. Yeah.
Another issue that is before the voters, a constitutional amendment, is Amendment 2 concerning campaign contributions. And, Bill, I'll turn to you for this because I know you have some thoughts about it. I'm particularly interested in if that were passed and sharply limit the amount that could be contributed, how would that impact the current campaign?
Well, there was an interesting story on the front of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch this morning about a $2 million, they called it a black money contribution to the Greitens campaign that was funneled through a couple of super PACs. If this proposition, this constitutional amendment passed, that kind of a contribution couldn't be made because it was actually a contribution to his campaign. I mean, you couldn't do even though we have Citizens United and unlimited corporate and labor union expenditures on political campaigns. That doesn't mean that a corporation can say, for example, give an unlimited contribution to a federal candidate. But because there are federal campaign contribution limits and other laws that affect corporate contributions, but there's no state limit on contributions. So this $2 million contribution that we do not know where it comes from. Was put into the campaign. Now, other parts of, I mean, this, like all these constitutional amendments, I mean, they bear no resemblance to the constitutional amendments that you see in the federal constitution, which are like short paragraphs or maybe a couple of paragraphs. These are just these long legislative enactments. And I think there are lots of problems in this particular one. I think maybe some parts of it may be at odds with Citizens United and you can't. In other words, violate the First Amendment. So I think there's some real questions about parts of this of this proposition, but at least it would stop that kind of a that kind of a $2 million huge undisclosed contribution in a state governor's race.
On the subject of constitutional amendments, another one that maybe you were alluding to there concerns the proposal to increase the cigarette tax by $1.27 a pack. And then there's a proposition on the ballot as well, which would ultimately increase the cigarette tax by 23 cents. Now, Jane, I know you're involved in some of
right.
this.
Right. So by way of disclosure, I represent Yes on Three for Kids.
Okay. So. Well, rather than getting into the merits of either of these, voters will decide that themselves. My question is, what happens if they both pass? I mean,
they can,
They can. And they can,
and
so we just add up the two taxes and
right. And I think Constitutional Amendment three, is a constitutional amendment. The other one is a statute. So, to the extent there were a conflict, the constitutional one would apply. But generally, if you have two identical measures, then the one that gets the most votes. But in this case. It is, and both sides agree because they oppose each other, but they both sides agree that both could be implemented. You could have a much larger tax. So that's sort of interesting. And another thing about all these ballot initiatives is the court's response to these. There used to be a lot more pre-election challenges, and the courts now have figured out that that's a very dicey move. So I think the pre-election challenges are going to slow down, which means you may have more on the ballot. But then we're presented with the issue that if there are defects in these, like there's one that was actually already been litigated about the bankers. The bankers are like excluded right. from being able to give contributions, yeah. but everybody else can, and that was declared unconstitutional.
So that's in the Proposition 2.
That's in Prop 2, but the court declined to sort of deal with that issue prior to the election. They're waiting to see if it actually passes before they determine. Then you get into the issue of, well, are you allowed to sever and take portions of things that have been voted on by the people and just pull a piece out, mm-hmm. which we've never sort of gotten to that point mm-hmm. because the courts have generally looked at it beforehand. But now we're going to be looking at things after, which is a very interesting dynamic.
And an example, and you may have a view on this, Jane, on Amendment 3, there are at least two parts of Amendment 3 that would seem to be, you know, either at odds or at least, raise a question of whether they're at odds with other parts of the Constitution, such as, some of this money from Amendment 3, the cigarette tax, would go to parochial could go to parochial schools. Mm-hmm. So that is potentially in violation of the very strict separation of church and state that Missouri has. Similarly, there's this question about stem cell research. There was an amendment passed saying that there were no limitations on stem cell research, and this Amendment 3 says none of the money from Amendment 3 will go to embryonic stem cell research, but it doesn't go on to state that no state money can go to embryonic stem cell research. So you have different, you have the supporters.
So what does the court, I disagree maybe with a little bit. I agree that it's there's no funding of embryonic stem
right.
cell, but the religious stuff. But so could a court go in and say, okay, we don't like that and we don't think that they can do that. Can they take that out? Which we've never gotten this far in initiative uh-huh. petition litigation before. And I've been doing these cases for 15, 20 years now, and we've never gotten this far. And uh-huh. so this is going to be a very right. interesting point. I actually agree with the court's approach because I think, one, you want to make sure if the voters vote for it. So we're going to start declaring things unconstitutional. Now, that means more stuff on the ballot. But I also think that I believe that if they can sever. They can sever, which means you don't throw out the voter's will. We had 330,000 people sign it. You don't throw that out. But if there's something that can be fixed without destroying the entire integrity of the amendment, then you do that. Right. And to me, that seems a more efficient way to handle it.
I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I do think it's not a good way to run a state, by having these, like Bill said, these huge amendments to our Constitution, which are put together. Put on the ballot, and then we vote, and nobody ever knows what they're voting on. because they don't read the whole thing.
Well,
and
try reading them in the Post-Dispatch, by the way, in their two-point font.
They're fine print.
I know. Right. We should talk to the Secretary of State about that. Right. I think we could bipartisan agree that they have to make the font bigger.
Yeah, absolutely.
All the elderly in the room agree with that.
Right, with our glasses, our reading glasses. Yeah.
We have a call from Tony in Florissant, and I'll take now on the tobacco tax. So let's get him in. Time's beginning to get away from us, Tony, so please make it quick.
I'll make it quick. Thank you very much. I had a question. I read in like an Art Labor magazine about, you know, these amendments we have coming up on our coming up election here. And my big one was, is I guess it's for the, I come in late, so I don't know what her name is on your show there, the lady.
Jane Dugan.
Pleasure to meet you. On this amendment we're going to have coming up with the tax, I guess, for the money that's going to be going to schools from the tobacco and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, it can't be used for anything else. But we also said that about casinos. Will they just take the money and then that they normally would allocate towards schooling and just reduce the amount out of the state funds?
Well, what you bring up a very interesting question, and it sort of answers the question of why is this in the Constitution, which I generally agree with these gentlemen that we shouldn't have sort of legislative-like things in our Constitution. The problem is because of the gaming revenue swap, where, yes, all the gaming money goes to education. The problem is the Missouri legislature backs out their general revenue contribution to the foundation formula in an amount equal to or generally more than what the gaming money came in. So education didn't net better off. That is the exact reason why Amendment 3 decided to go to a constitutional amendment like MoDOT, like the conservation tax, so that the legislature cannot revenue swap and divert the money. So while I agree generally we don't like these big things in Constitution, in Amendment 3's position, we had to do that or they would take the money again. And people did get burned by the gaming money, and that's a legitimate concern. And that's why we are doing it this way, because we don't want a revenue swap.
Okay. Enough of that. Let's take one more call. Zach is joining us from Webster Groves. He's going to take us back to the beginning of the program and the issues there. Go ahead, Zach. You're on the air, but quickly, please.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So two quick things. I wonder, you know, when we talk about rigging in a national election, do we really need to think about it in terms of every state in the nation, or are we really only talking about needing to rig elections in about four of the swing states? And then my other one is a comment, which is just about how Jane Duker sleeps at night when she's a corporate shill.
Right. Oh, thanks.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you for inserting that.
Yeah, because not everybody is entitled to representation.
As a lawyer, that's what you do, is you represent your clients. And that doesn't mean you think your clients are right or wrong always.
You have a duty of loyalty and you take on their
calls. We have a duty
coffee.
As lawyers to that's represent right. other people. Now, it's a lot easier to represent well-paying clients, but I'm sure you take pro bono cases,
absolutely.
Too, where people are – and I did that, too, when I was a lawyer. And I represented big corporations, and that paid the bills and stuff, but – I also represented prisoners who didn't have anyone else to represent them, and I didn't really particularly like them as people, but they'd still needed representation. That's the way our system works.
And I agree with that. On the other part of the question, yes, you probably – I mean, if you're Donald Trump trying to rig the election, you probably would have to rig it in about four different battleground states. I mean, but, you know, if we think about the 2000 election –
But it's not even the state, though, because then you have to get into every single
counties,
locality.
Yes.
I mean, I would beg to see that anyone would be able to – and I'm telling you, we've had a lot of politicians and a lot of people who've been running elections, and if they had thought about – if they'd been able to do it, we'd have seen it already. I mean, and the idea that you could do that – so, yes, I agree that elections generally come down to a few states, but the idea that you know that ahead of time
– for-profit places where – like law firms where they're really smart people and an institution like WashU and then, the police department. I mean, it's hard for all of them to just get things to work the right way. I mean, it is so hard to get things to work just the right way. This idea that then you're going to have some master conspiracy behind the scenes.
It's hard enough to do it
people
right.
People are not that smart.
Yeah.
There's an interesting piece yesterday saying that if people wanted to interfere with the election, such as the Russians, for instance, they could do it with disrupting the grid or using their abilities with the Internet to disrupt to some of the electronics.
Yeah, that was Die Hard 4. Yeah, I saw that one too.
But in fact, if they shut down all the electricity or shut down, that could happen.
Actually, frankly, the voting is the least of our problems. problems, and it's something that we could, you know, hold the election again, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. I just don't – I agree with you. If ever you can't complain government is worthless and ineffective and then say, oh, yes, but they could, you know, somehow rig the elections in all these localities. It's sort of silly.
We're going to have to end it there. I wanted to talk about minimum wage. Suffice it to say that the Missouri Supreme Court is going to decide on the minimum wage for the city of St. Louis. Jane Duker, thank you for being with us. Great to see you. Bill Freivogel, as always, and same to you, Mark Smith.
Thank
Welcome
you.
Back. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/STL On Air. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.